Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We're going to start with talking about the California Single Payer Initiative, which has just gotten shelved and put back in the Rules Committee, so we won't be voting on that in the Assembly anytime soon. I had a chance this week to read the bill and look at an analysis, an economic analysis. This was done by the Political Economy Research Institute, and the author of that was a Dr. Roland Paulin. And what he had to say about it was that it'll probably actually lower health care for the average person in California. Let me say that again. We're going to cover everybody, and it's actually going to lower health care costs. How on earth can you make that work? Well, the answer is you take the 35% of costs that are currently going to pay executive salaries and expenses of the insurance company, as of commercial insurance, and you've got an awful lot of money to play with. We've got 2.7 million uninsured right now in California. That's 7% of the state. And we're currently spending 14% of our state GDP on healthcare. And that's on top of what we're getting in terms of federal assistance for Medicaid and Medicare and healthy families and CHIP and all of these other programs that are federally funded. What the research at the Political Economy Research Institute said was, you know, running the numbers as it's proposed, the out-of-pocket cost for an average middle-class family would be 9%. Small businesses, less than nine people, will actually get a 22% reduction on their costs. Believe me, as a small business person, that sounds pretty good. And the way this works is that there will be a Healthy California board, which will have nine members, and they will be appointed. So some details to be outlined there. Some interesting cautions in the bill that I thought were really good is that all of the health data will be specifically by statute unavailable to law enforcement, to the federal government, to ICE. So we really will be able to protect people's privacy and their healthcare privacy. There is also some fairly stiff penalties for anybody revealing information. So they've thought that part of it through. The problem is that the bill is in its current form not going to go into effect until the costs are all analyzed and until all of the permissions and waivers and things that are needed to reuse that federal money go through. But, you know, on the face of it, as a person who has been running a medical practice now since 1990, I'd say that it could work both for the doctors, the hospitals. Did I mention that I was on the board of directors for Dominican Hospital for about 6 years? So I know the hospital financing end of things. This could really work. The devil's always in the details, and I certainly want to see those details well elucidated. But I'm optimistic that California can pull this off. I'm wondering if other people have different ideas or want to chime in support of that. Our next story is about migraine prevention. And I thought this was particularly interesting because of the people who are out there who get migraines, there's about 40% of people with recurrent migraine who get them often enough that they should be taking some sort of preventative or prophylactic therapy, but only around 10% do. And part of the reason for that is the adverse side effects for the common pharmaceuticals that are used for migraine. So we're talking about anti-epileptic drugs like valproic acid, topiramate, which these cause a lot of drowsiness. Lots of the beta blockers, metoprolol, propranolol, timolol are effective, and they're very effective, but they lower blood pressure. And so people can have problems with lightheadedness and syncope. Antidepressants, the old ones like amitriptyline and new ones like venlafaxine, are also approved for migraine. They're probably effective, but they have side effects as well. So what's a migrainer to do? Well, you might want to try melatonin. Melatonin has about greater than 50% improvement in migraine frequency and a reduction in migraine severity. And we're talking about a dose of 3 milligrams. This was a study recently published, 196 adults, age range from 18 to 65 with chronic migraines. They had to have at least 3 attacks per month to be part of the study, and they took either placebo, 3 milligrams of melatonin, or 25 milligrams of amitriptyline, which I will tell you is a pretty hefty dose of amitriptyline, every night. What they found after 8 weeks was that the frequency of migraines had dropped substantially in the melatonin group from 6 migraine days to 4.6 migraine days, and the duration of the migraines was reduced by about 4 hours. Both of these were super highly statistically significant improvements, and they were both better than the results for amitriptyline, which of the drugs out there is one of the more commonly used. I think that what we need to realize is that this was a product that said 3 milligrams on its label. I don't know which product it was. Your results could vary. And if you try this with melatonin and you are taking 3 milligrams and not seeing a benefit, I would probably go and buy a different brand and try it with at least 2 different brands, because unfortunately we do have consistency issues from drug to drug. And I think that's just one of those problems that we're going to be stuck with for the foreseeable future. Another story that really caught my eye, this one comes from a product of the New England Journal of Medicine, it's called Journal Watch, where they go through their journals and they pull articles that might be of interest to primary care doctors. And this particular issue had a lot of good stuff in it. So I'm going to start with this really scary article about short-term corticosteroids. So we're talking about prednisone. Hey, if you're out there hiking, you might get some poison oak. This study, among other things, showed that the frequency of people over 3 years, those adult patients over 3 years, 1 out of 5 of them got a short course of corticosteroid therapy, and they were given for such indications as poison oak or an asthma attack, respiratory infections, maybe a person with bad disc disease who flared themselves up, push starting their car, for example. So you would often give their steroids in these indications. And I'm not critiquing the doctors, because quite honestly, I thought that was a pretty safe thing to do until I read this study. So we're talking about only 6 days of steroid therapy, and we're talking about only 20 milligrams a day. Half of these people got something called a Medrol dose pack. And that's just because it's quick and easy to give people that, and they make fewer mistakes with their dosing. What the researchers found was that there were substantial risks associated with increased rates, almost double the rates of sepsis from 1 per 1,000 person years to 1.8, a really significant increase, a doubling of venous thromboembolism. So that's the blood clot in your leg that has the potential to go to your lungs and give you a pulmonary infarction. That's a big deal. And fracture. So 21% per 1,000 people who had gotten steroids had a fracture. And these risks, particularly the fracture risk, was doubled during the 5 to 30 days after the prescription date for the steroids. That's really odd to me, that you could increase your fracture risk so quickly with steroids. That one blew my mind, folks. I don't understand the mechanism, but a doubling statistically, hey, That's something to look at. The risk for thromboembolism, that went up 300%, threefold, and this was a really substantial increase. So, look, if you really need those steroids because you're in agony, if you really are covered with poison oak, if you have severe asthma and you might end up in the hospital, you got to take the steroids. You got to take these risks. We're talking about a doubling of a rare event. But still, from the way that we deal these things out as if they were harmless candy, because until I saw this study, I kind of figured, hey, 6 days, no big deal. They'll be off it soon. This is going to change my practicing. And I'm hoping that we'll reach the ears of other physicians and make them think twice. But most particularly, I want to reach the ears of the consumers and have you ask yourself, just as you should when the doctor pulls out his prescription pad and wants to give you an antibiotic, doctor, do I really need this antibiotic or is this just a precaution? Well, you should be asking the same question with steroids. Do I really need this? Could I try using non-steroidal methods? Could I try using curcumin and fish oil for a few days? Could I try just using a topical steroid on my poison oak? Because, hey, it's only my arm and I think I can live with it. Maybe you should be asking that question. Well, before I leave this topic, I'm going to promote a product that I am not getting paid to promote. It's called Zanfel, Z-A-N-F-E-L, and this is a miracle product for poison oak. It's pretty expensive, but, you know, if we're looking at $40 so that you can sleep for the next week because your poison oak goes away, well, you decide whether you've got that much discretionary income, but I will tell you, if this product used as directed has extremely, extremely benefited yours truly, who is highly sensitive to the poison oak rash and has pets. So that'll tell you everything you know if you live in the Monterey Bay Area. Let me jump to this one. This is about colon cancer and colonoscopy and using a test. This is what I recommend, by the way. It's called the Fecal Immunochemical Test, or FIT. Your doctor can give you a prescription for this. I have not had any problems getting insurance to pay for it. And what this does is it's an antibody test against human hemoglobin. So you can have that rare steak the night before and not test positive for blood, unless you're Hannibal the Cannibal, of course, in which case, yeah. But really, this is a great way to avoid colonoscopy, because if you do a FIT test every year or you get a colonoscopy every 10 years, these two are equivalent in terms of their ability to pick up cancer. This study looked at, well, if a FIT test is positive, how long can we afford to wait? But what the study also did was gave me some numbers to share with you. So there were this was a large California healthcare system. I'm presuming Kaiser, but I don't know that for sure. There were 1.26 million patients who were screened with FIT cards, and about 100,000 had positive cards. Of them, they managed to get 70,000, almost 70%, let me tell you, that's pretty darn good, in to undergo a colonoscopy. And of that 70,000, they found 2,200 cancers. So what that means is that if you have a positive FIT card, don't freak out. The chances that you've actually got cancer are 1 in 35. On the other hand, if they screened 1.26 million people and they had 100,000 positives, then what that means is that you can, with a high probability, 90%, about 92%, you can avoid ever having a colonoscopy just by doing the stool cards every year and having them come up negative. And you can avoid the complications, potentially, of colonoscopy, of which, in my experience, there are two. One rare, which is perforation, and one not so rare, which is I've had a lot of patients who got messed up by the PrEP, and it messed with their microbiome, and they began having irritable bowel symptoms after doing the clean out for a colonoscopy. So it somehow affected them adversely. And I went and looked online. I checked Google Scholar, could not find any research looking at this. So I have to tell you, this is purely anecdotal. It's not hard science here, but I still think it's something really important for us to be thinking about. So I want to put that out there. Now, meat and potatoes about that. How long can you wait after that positive FIT test for a colonoscopy? And it turns out that you can, if you get it done within 30 days, they're going to find cancers in about 3% of them and advanced cancers in about 0.8% of them. You can wait 9 months and those numbers don't change. Between 10 and 12 months, they creep up a little bit, 4.9 and 1.9%. So now we've doubled the number of advanced cancers. Well, that means you should have gotten in there earlier. You can still be cured, but some of those cancers actually managed to escape the pen over that few months between 9 months and 12 months. Very important because it tells us something about the natural history and it tells us how early the FIT cards are picking up cancers, which is to say, not that early. It's picking them up when they begin to bleed. And at least in some cases, they begin to bleed shortly, you know, within a year before they spread. So you don't want to wait until 12 months or a year. And certainly as a doctor, I don't want to not get in the face of my patient and say, hey, you really should do this. You're running a risk of cancer here. I'm the sort of doctor who doesn't make my patients sign a release when they go against my advice, and except under very, very rare circumstances, like not treating a breast cancer. But I think it's important for people to take some personal responsibility when the doctor tells them, look, you really should get this follow-up test. You know what? You probably should really get the follow-up test. So I've got a shout out to people who suffer from gout. So folks with gout, you need to pay attention. It's cherry season, and you might just want to cherry bomb your gout. Now, gout's caused by the substance called uric acid. Uric acid is a byproduct of fructose metabolism. And by the way, we tell people to not eat so much meat, because, of course, meat has protein, and protein has it gets broken down to uric acid. But I'm going to tell you, don't drink soda. Don't eat food with high fructose corn syrup in it. Flip that label over and eat food. If you're going to eat sugar, eat sugar. Don't eat corn sugar, corn syrup, or high fructose corn syrup, because you're actually going to aggravate your gout. So read those labels, folks, because the powers that be that run our industrial food chain are cramming all of the fructose they can down our throats, and we need to resist that. So it turns out, and this is, there have been research about this, but I want to tell you about this study. This was done, published in 2012, and it was out of Boston University. They had 600 people with chronic gout, and they gave them about three servings of cherries over a 48-hour period, and they reduced the acute gout attacks substantially, like 35%. Pretty good, right, for eating 10 or 12 cherries three times over 48 hours. Cherries reduce the frequency of gout by increasing uric acid excretion. So what you want to do is eat about, 280 grams of cherries is enough to drastically reduce your gout attacks. There are a number of studies that looked at how fast does it work. It works in about 48 hours. It drops your it increases your uric acid excretion within 3 hours. And so there is a strong risk of or improvement in gout. So how much do you want to take? Well, it depends on whether you're eating cherries. We're talking about maybe 10 or 12 cherries a day. You can buy cherry juice. I have seen it in frozen form. That might be a good thing to throw into your smoothie. A tablespoon of cherry juice would probably be about the right dose for a daily preventative. and it's got some other healthful antioxidants in it. You can also buy, some product here that they're talking about called N2 Gout, which has 600 milligrams of cherry powder per capsule. That sounds pretty good if you want to do just taking a pill. Myself, I'm big on just figuring out how to do it with food. So yes, dried cherries are available and dried cherries would work. So think about doing that. You're listening to Ask Dr. Dawn on KSCO. We're going to go to some emails. Oh, and by the way, if you decide that you would like to email or there's something that I've said on this show that you want to share with others, we do post this program and highlights as well at AskDrDawn.com. And you can also go to iTunes or you can go to wherever you get your podcasts and search Ask Dr. Dawn. You'll find us there and you can get me and our edited shows, not all of which appear on this station, delivered to the most convenient device you've got, which might be the one in your pocket. And from there to the completely portable device you've got, your brain. Now let's go to an email. This from Ryan in Monterey. Ryan wrote, I caught your appearance on KZSC earlier tonight. And thank you, John Sandich, for allowing me to be a monthly guest on his program Talk About out there on KZSC at the university. I was especially intrigued, continues Ryan, about your comments on gut-to-brain connection. I am 33, male, non-smoker, no drugs or excessive alcohol, and with no serious health issues past or present. Well, none except for depression, which has been around for quite a while. I've tried a handful of medications, but have shied away from them due to adverse mental reactions and just a general aversion to messing with my brain chemistry so directly. My question is, which specific strains of probiotics have been linked to help with depression, and where is the best place to acquire them? A little additional information. I have very sporadic eating habits, and when I'm down, I generally have no appetite and go for a day or two without eating, followed by one or two very small meals a day. I work long hours as a salaried executive chef, so go figure. Thank you so much for taking the time to read this. I'm a huge fan ever since I heard you back on KWSP. Your bevy of knowledge paired with your gentle voice has seriously calmed me down on many, many times. Well, the first thing I want to recommend, Ryan, is that you get yourself checked for a vitamin D level. There are a lot of depressed people out there who get better just by getting their vitamin D level up to about 40 nanograms per ml. So that's an important place to start. But to address your questions, a lot of us think about probiotics the way we might think about a basic garden. If I just grow the right flowers or grow the right vegetables in my gut garden, I'm going to be fine. And that is true to a certain extent, but it's simplistic and it really doesn't tell the whole story. So I'm going to give a little bit of a gut 2.0 function. So you get the gut's full of bacteria, so many bacteria, you wouldn't believe it. More cells than you've got in your body by 10 to 100 times. And those cells are, some of them, bad actors that inflame the gut, elevate the immune system. And when there's inflammation in the gut starts to leak. The inflammation is also killing some of those bad bacteria, and some of them die a natural death. And the bacteria release compounds called lipopolysaccharides. Some of the lipopolysaccharides are actually beneficial and do good things for the gut, but the majority of them are actually going to get into your bloodstream and potentially get to your brain and cause inflammation in your bloodstream, and that inflammation in your bloodstream leads to inflammation in your brain, and then you've got a leaky brain, and that's what's been associated with depression, is actually these substances that are coming off of the bacteria that are having an inflammatory effect on the brain. Not to mention, there's this huge nerve called the vagus nerve that goes directly from the gut to the brain, and it's a two-way communications channel. And that channel, when the communications of inflammation that go to the brain actually contribute to this depression. So I'm going to quote from an article that appeared in a journal called Nutrition Volume 32, Issue 3, March 2016, page 315. They did for 3 weeks, they gave people Lactobacillus acidophilus, 2 billion, which I would consider a low dose, Lactobacillus caseae, also 2 billion, and Bifidobacterium bifidum. These are common probiotics that are in most mixes of probiotics. And what they found was a super, super statistically significant 0.001. That's 1 in 1,000 chance it's wrong. That's as good as it gets in statistics, folks. They, in 8 weeks, they dropped the depression inventory by 25 to 30%. They also decreased high sensitivity C-reactive protein in the bloodstream. They decreased insulin resistance in the bloodstream, and they increased glutathione, which is your body's master antioxidant, and all this by just feeding some probiotics into the system. So thank you for your excellent question, Ryan. I'm sure a lot of people are frantically writing that down, but it will appear on the website, and I will try to post on the website a link to that article, or it may just be a link to the extract, but we'll get it for you there. All right, we're going to try to go to our next caller.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Hi. This is Don, 72-year-old white male in generally good health. I've always had a sweet tooth, but I've noticed in the last couple of years, increasingly, if I eat too much sugar, I get chest congestion. And I'm wondering who's not doing their job.
Well, okay. Do you have any history of allergies? Hay fever, anything like that?
Hay fever, allergies, mild asthma. I've never had an attack.
But. Okay. But yeah, so one thing, first of all, do the sugar, but no dairy, just to be sure that this isn't a pure dairy effect, because if it's ice cream that you're considering too much sugar, it might be something other than what you think it is. So do that test. Let's take it as read that you're gonna eat a lot of sugar that isn't dairy and see if you get congested. So if in fact it's not just the dairy effect, but it's actually a sugar effect, it's probably affecting your microbiome. How long does it take to see the shift, and how long does the shift last, the congestion?
It takes about 20 minutes before I feel it, and lasts for a couple of hours.
Okay, so what I think is going on there is that's about one bacterial generation. So is that amazing? 20 minutes and the bacteria are already divided.
All right.
So I don't think that it's a direct microbiome feedback loop. I think it's probably related to hair trigger inflammation in your system. And what's happening is that when you eat too much sugar, your insulin kicks up. And that happens fairly quickly, certainly within 20 minutes, basically within 5. And I think what happens is when your insulin and the other compounds that are released that are pro-inflammatory, like IL-10, those are coming off of your white blood cells, and they're lowering your threshold, making you more likely to congest because you're on a hair trigger due to your asthma and your allergies. So you're getting a very rapid effect due to just a little bit more inflammation, kind of like, okay, a little low-level fire, and then someone throws some gasoline on it, and bam, it flames up. So I think that's probably what's going on there. So I believe that you could benefit a lot by doing some surgery on your microbiome. So what I'm going to suggest is, you know, sugar's not that good for you, so you might want to back it down. But you want to start encouraging a healthy microbiome. And so going on a gut diet for a couple of weeks, and I'll outline what that is. Actually, you can go to my website at Ask Dr. Don and go into the resources, and you'll find something called the Comprehensive Elimination Diet. And if you follow that for a month and then see what happens, but I bet you your sugar reaction would evaporate or attenuate substantially after a month on that diet, because that's going to restore a lot of things in your microbiome. You could help that effect along by taking some probiotics. I recommend taking 25 to 50 billion, with a B, organisms a day. And while you're doing that, you also want to be eating fruits and vegetables, which you will be doing if you're following the elimination diet, because it includes lots of fruits and vegetables, and it really drops your grain consumption. So just getting rid of the grain and reducing the sugar for a month will drastically shift your microbiome. And if you're taking at least 10 billion Lactobacillus rhamnosus, R-H-A-M-N-O-S-U-S, rhamnosus, that's on a lot of these probiotics, you will shift your thresholds, I believe, quite substantially. And then you'll be able to enjoy the occasional sugar splurge, probably without getting your congestion. And I would not be surprised if you have fewer aches and pains and maybe more regular bowel movements, if that's an issue for you. Certainly less diarrhea, if that's an issue for you. And really, the benefits, it can be remarkable to just going to more plants and leaner proteins, because it shifts your microbiome quite rapidly. But you probably also have some food sensitivities, because you've got the setup for that, which is the history of asthma and the history of allergies.
Interesting. Well, the allergies, at least that I know about, are largely pollen.
Right. But you see, what happens is that tells us about how your immune system is wired. In our society, in particular, when we are children, we're exposed to antibiotics, and we're not exposed to enough dirt, and we don't get any parasites. And humans were designed, basically, to live in a dirty environment. And some of that dirt actually provides useful education, if you will, to the immune system. The uneducated immune system attacks everything because it doesn't know what to take seriously and what's benign. But the educated immune system, which is like a child growing up in Burkina Faso, for example, where they're getting all kind, they might have some whipworm, they might have some minor parasites, but what they've also got is an educated immune system that isn't going to get fooled by ragweed pollen and think that that's something that's going to hurt it. I mean, it knows what bad looks like. It's like streetwise, and it knows when to be scared and when not to worry. But our immune systems and our culture aren't like that, unfortunately. And, you know, if you were a C-section, if your mom got antibiotics interpartum because she had, let's say, premature rupture of the membranes, and we don't want the baby to get septic, so we use these antibiotics, but then we mess with the establishment of a healthy microbiome. And if there's also a family history of allergy, those kids are setups. And I see it again and again and again. This is what we call functional medicine. Regular doctors, it's all very scientific. It's all there in the literature. Regular doctors are just now beginning to get some education about it. Because unfortunately, regular doctors get their education from drug companies, and drug companies really don't want them to know this. And, you know, so we've got a little problem. We're working on it. I teach for the Institute. We're trying to get doctors to get the message. But part of the reason I'm here on Saturday afternoon is to get that message out to the public. So thanks for calling, and any follow-up questions?
No. Thank you very much. And I will look at your website for the diet.
All right. Very good. And give us a call back next month or the month after, and let us know how it went.
Yes, excellent. One comment. I have noticed a really nice improvement in overall health when I started using a digestive enzyme, and that's been really important.
I'm glad to hear it. It does make a big difference, but ultimately what we'd like to do is have you be able to have your own digestive enzymes work for you. And so this may go a long way to helping with that. You should give that a try about week 3.5. If you do the diet that long, just go without the digestive enzymes and see if you don't need them when you're eating like that. Well, okay. Ciao for now.
Bye.
So we're back doing email. So this one's from Shaul in Israel. He's a longtime podcast listener. And Shaul writes, "You on May 21st, 2017 podcast, you recommended 12 hours of fasting every day by eating two meals per day at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. I'm a 70-year-old male, feel good, and make sports. I'm vegan, but eat eggs and fish." And then you're not vegan, but okay. "And no dairy products. My BMI is 19, even though I eat every day 2,000 calories. I had lymphoma 3 years ago. I used to eat 3 main meals and 2 in between with fruits and nuts. Because of your recommendation, I'm now eating only 3 meals a day, and later I attend 2 meals a day. And at 70, Shal, I'll just interject and say, as long as you get a 12-hour fast somewhere in that 24-hour cycle, you will be getting the effect that we're looking for on your mitochondria, which will reduce your risk of cancer and reduce your risk of dementia or neurodegeneration. So I think you need to maintain your weight. Now, we'll get to his question. You mentioned in the past that to reduce the chance of cancer to come back, we have to limit our intake of calorie from sugar sources to less than 150 kilocalories per meal. So do you recommend 2 meals also for me? And yes, what I would suggest you do, Shal, is make sure that you aren't losing weight. If you are feeling weak or losing your energy in the middle of the day, then you may have to eat a small snack. I would recommend maybe nuts or some lean protein, perhaps a soy product, for example. But add oils back in. And you did mention that no dairy products. So for everyone else who's thinking about doing this, I'll say if you're a cancer survivor and you're looking to stay in remission long term, I'm a little iffy on cheese, and that has to do with some of the growth factors in cheese. And there are some statistical studies that are epidemiological, which means that they're not that good scientifically because of all sorts of reasons, selection bias and other things you can criticize. But that being said, it is a fact that milk is essentially designed for rapidly growing baby animals. And it's not designed by nature for adult animals. And the rapidly growing part, well, it has growth factors in it. And what if the cancer could read those growth factors and it currently is sitting in a bone marrow somewhere completely asleep because of all of your good behavior? Or maybe there's a precancer out there that's going to shift and suddenly be able to respond to the growth factors. So for people who've had cancer once, I generally am saying, we don't know that, we can't really show that dairy is safe, and there is some reason to think it may not be safe. So play it safe and find other sources for protein. This one from Dee Dee in Monterey. Cream prep for psoriasis-like condition affecting the fingertips. I wanted to share with you an amazingly effective home remedy for dry, cracking, painful skin. Before we go any further, I want you to understand, folks, this is a crowdsourced bit of advice. I have not personally tested it. I am putting it out there for you with just the one warning that people can have allergies to essential oils. So you might get a dermatitis from this, but you probably won't. Onward. My husband has had cracking on the tips of his fingers for decades and tried different treatments, all with only partial results. A coworker recommended a home recipe that had healed his painful scaling psoriasis, and she wanted to give you the recipe. So here it is. 3/4 of a cup of Epsom salts, 1 cup of white sugar, 1/4 cup of almond oil, 1/2 cup of coconut oil, 10 drops of lavender oil, 5 drops of peppermint oil. Let it sit for a couple of days after mixing, and then rub it into the affected areas for about 2 minutes daily, and then wash it off. And so Diane's crowdsourced report was that it worked for her husband, and it worked for her friend, and maybe it will work for you. And aside from the allergy issue, this stuff looks pretty benign to me. So maybe go ahead and give it a try. Okay, Ellen in California writes, bile reflux. Dr. Don, my 25-year-old nephew has recently been diagnosed with bile reflux and has been suffering from it for years. It's the result of the mechanisms in his stomach allowing the bile in. I do not know the medical term for this mechanism. It's not important, but it's that the pylorus, the sphincter muscle on the stomach, is not closing properly. Are there other alternatives to taking acid reflux medication? And yes, Ellen, there are. And it's interesting how well this dovetails with what we were talking about a little while ago. So bile reflux is when the bile coming from your gallbladder, instead of staying in your small intestine, manages to get into your stomach, where it acts as a serious irritant. And from the stomach, it often gets into the esophagus, which has no protection against the bile, and you can get a profound esophagitis. This is not ever normal. This is something wrong physiologically. If we as a doctor cut the vagus nerve, which used to be a thing before we realized that ulcers were caused by bacteria and ibuprofen and not by a stress, we used to cut the vagus nerve, and that did eliminate stomach acid, but that's actually not a good thing. And a lot of those people developed bile reflux, because if you keep the pH in the stomach too high, then the gate to the small intestine stays open all the time, and the bile, we bend over and there's bile, it'll kind of go up the wrong way and irritate the stomach. And then you'll have an irritated gate that won't close, and then the gate to the esophagus gets irritated and that won't close, and now you're coming in with heartburn symptoms, and the doctor gives you a proton pump inhibitor to block your stomach acid, which helps alleviate your symptoms, but doesn't do anything to reduce your risk of esophageal cancer from the bile, which is still coming up. So we're going to start with talking about some protective things that your nephew can be doing. And the first thing he needs to do is figure out if he has any food sensitivities, because that's the most common cause of bile reflux. So he needs to go on that elimination diet that is posted on my website, askdrdon.com, that I talked about a little while ago. And he should really do it for about 3 or 4 weeks. And other things that are protective, demulcents. So deglycerized licorice, which I never say correctly, but it's called DGL, and aloe vera are things that coat the esophagus and soothe the stomach. Extra stomach acid, it might work if he's not too irritated, but what will work is digestive bitters, which you can buy at any health food store, and mindful eating. So here's mindful eating. You eat without doing anything else while you're eating. You don't watch TV. You don't text. You don't read. You actually are focusing your consciousness on the food. And you chew. You want to chew about 15 times every single mouthful. And you want to smell each bite of food before you put it in your mouth. And you want it. And you want to feel that saliva in your mouth. If you do this, it seems like a terrible bother, but what it does is it allows the brain to kickstart or reboot the vagus nerve, and it allows the vagus nerve to start making stomach acid, and it allows the vagus nerve to stimulate the gallbladder and the pancreas to get ready to digest the food that's going to come down the pike in about 20 or 30 minutes. And when you digest that food, the bile has something to work on, and you'll actually, with mindful eating, turn down the bile excretion until the stomach's ready to empty. So you're like rebooting a computer system that's gotten itself confused and needs reconfiguration. It's an extremely effective tactic. So that's my advice for your nephew. Karen from Boston writes, "Enjoy your show all the way from Boston. Was listening to the patient question about itchy skin and probiotics for them. There is a company with a lot of research behind it, well, not really a lot, called Mother Dirt. Would love to hear your opinion of this. Ammonia-eating bacteria is what they've put in the Mother Dirt. And so what they're trying to do is repopulate your microbiome with what the child in Burkina Faso has growing on their skin, which allows them to eat the ammonia that's being produced by the bacteria that make odor, and that will actually work. You will reduce your body odor. The trouble is, and I tried to do this. I got the stuff, and I tried to use their soap, and I tried to squirt it in my underarms twice a day. And I had a really hard time managing to do what I needed to do, which was only use their soap, because I go to the gym and I need to take a shower. So I took some of their soap, and basically it was hard to implement. But I do think if you wanted to get rid of your body odor, that this would be a successful strategy. I do think the science is legitimate, and I think it's a really interesting thing to consider trying. So, short one going out to Jalen in Santa Cruz. This was a query. Jalen had previously called in to the guest show that I do one Wednesday a month, and we never know when. So you just have to go to my website, askdrdawn.com, so you can also look for upcoming appearances. Anyway, she did some of the advice. She downloaded the Headspace app and has been using that to calm herself down. And she's been using the Sleepy Time Tea for her anxieties. But she wondered about the magnesium threonate. Magnesium, threonate. And that magnesium is a special kind of magnesium that gets across the blood-brain barrier. Its commercial name is mag-teen, T-E-I-N. You can buy it on the internet. There are a number of products that work well. I am in my office using one called Protozorb because I found it to be one of the most cost-effective sources, and I'm always trying to get the price down for my patients. One thing that Jalen was really worried about was whether this would create a problem for her. 99% of the time I'm driving with my son, so I'd be very afraid of taking anything that might sedate me. The magnesium threonate is not sedating. It is calming, and there's a difference. Okay, sedation is where you hit the receptors in a way that imitates a drug. But what we're really doing with the magtine is we're changing the ratio of adrenaline to serotonin, dopamine, and acetylcholine. An anxious brain has too much adrenaline. So we're reducing the adrenaline by giving the magnesium. It does not cause sedation. It's relaxing, but not in a way that makes you sleepy. And in terms of, it makes you actually think more clearly, because too much adrenaline gets you into fight or flight mode and you start to have problems. So please tune in next month. And thank you very much for listening. I look forward to talking with you at the next program. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.